Hi, it's Robin Young. Thank you for listening to Here and Now. If you love this show, thank you again. And you may also love other great podcasts and shows and the journalism brought to you by NPR. When you support your local public radio station, it helps us keep our program going and helps NPR create new ones. So the best way to keep both Here and Now and NPR strong is to donate to your station. Visit donate.npr.org/now to give, then share why you did using the hashtag WhyPublicRadio. Thanks. President Trump is applying pressure on Republican senators to pass their version of a major tax plan with a vote that may come as soon as Wednesday. Today, he's meeting with lawmakers on Capitol Hill. This morning, he tweeted that with just a few changes, some mathematical, the middle class and job producers can get even more in actual dollars. Well, Senate leaders are reportedly making those changes to get the support of Republicans still on the fence. And pressure is also growing to change the secretive way sexual harassment cases are handled in Congress. So let's start the hour with NPR congressional reporter Susan Davis. Hi, Sue.
Hey, Robin. How are you doing?
I'm good. And lawmakers are scrambling, we hear, doing some deal-making changes, as the president said, to get those reluctant Republicans on board. What kind of horse trading are you hearing about?
Well, there's a couple of things we have to are watching for. Mm-hmm. One of the bigger overarching questions is the senators who have voiced concerns about what the tax bill might do to the deficit, specifically John McCain of Arizona, Jeff Flake of Arizona, and Bob Corker of Tennessee. The question of does this bill satisfy their concerns is still an open one, and we're going to be watching for that this week. And then there's also the question of things that are in the bill that some senators might not like or want to improve. For example, Susan Collins, who's a senator from Maine, has said she would like to see this bill do more for the middle class. Is there tweaks they can do to the bill to get her vote? And then there's things that they've put in the bill to secure other senators' votes. Good example of that is Lisa Murkowski of Alaska. The bill is expected to include language that will allow for drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, which has been a priority for the Republican Party for decades, and specifically for Lisa Murkowski.
Yeah, well, then there are the pass-throughs. These are the businesses that feel they're unfairly taxed more than big corporations. Republican Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin, who's a businessman, is one of the leading voices calling for change there. But again, if all these little goodies are given out, that brings us back to that deficit problem. I just want to underscore what you were saying about the concern of people like McCain. This is the Byrd rule. It's
yes.
A condition of the budget reconciliation process that legislation to pass with only 51 votes has to not increase the deficit by more than something like $1.5 trillion in the first 10 years. So how many goodies can they add?
Well, this is the tough math, right? And part of the reason we saw senators do things like include in the Senate bill essentially effectively ending the individual mandate in the Affordable Care Act is because doing that from a tax policy perspective is expected to give the federal government additional revenue somewhere in the tune of about $350 billion over that 10 years. So Republicans are taking that $350 billion and counting that math towards other things like increasing the child tax credit or spending it in other places. But you're right. I mean, the math is finite. They can only do so much and still contribute no more than $1.5 trillion over the next 10 years to the deficit. Otherwise, they couldn't bring it to the floor under these special rules that let it pass with only 50 votes plus one.
Right. Some of the changes we're hearing about over the weekend, the House bill has a provision that would roll back a 1954 law that bans churches and other nonprofits from engaging in political activity. So there's eyebrows raised there.
Yep.
The House bill would eliminate the teacher spending deduction. I just want to get this in here. Teachers spend on average about $500 to buy their own school supplies. They can get maybe $100 back. That might go away. So there's going to be some eyebrows raised over this. But in the time we have left, sexual harassment and the debate over it has, you could say, overshadowed all these tax plans. And there's these calls to make the congressional approach more transparent. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, one thing that Congress is doing immediately in the short term, and the House will vote on it this week, the Senate already has, is to mandate sexual harassment training every year at the start of Congresses for all employees, including lawmakers. So that it will be a new change. There is also legislation that's been introduced in both the House and Senate that is going through the committee process that would completely remake the process by which people who feel like they've been harassed, not just for sexual harassment, but for any harassment reason, age, race, other types of discrimination, to make the process more transparent, to give victims more legal rights, and to put more transparency when these settlements are paid out, and they're paid for with our tax dollars, to let the public know where that money's coming from.
Well, we learned last week that there's many of us who didn't know that there's an office that paid out $17 million in all kinds of workplace settlements, but also lawmakers like Congressman Conyers used their office budget to do that. And the people who were the accusers had to pay for their own lawyers and representation while the congressman didn't.
That is correct. And this was paid through what's called an MRA. It's the member budget that they get for each office. This is something that the House Ethics Committee is likely going to look at in the process of that. And I'm told that the House Administration Committee, which has jurisdiction over this, is going to hold a hearing next week looking at these settlements and how they're paid out and how they can improve the system.
Well, we'll follow all of this. NPR congressional reporter, busy week for you. Susan Davis, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, just up the street from the White House, there is a showdown going on today at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Two people claiming to be the acting director of the financial watchdog agency showed up for work. One was the White House budget director Mick Mulvaney, who was following President Trump's orders to step in. He came with a box of donuts. The other was Leandra English, who got the job from outgoing director Richard Cordray. Both tried to assert their power today, and the fight is heading to court. For more, we're joined by NPR's Uri Berliner. Uri, what happened? Do employees know which one of these bosses to report to?
No, they don't, because as you said, they both tried to stake their claim today to the acting director job. I mean, it was a really strange scene, probably unlike any at any workplace in Washington, D.C. for really quite some time. What we know is that Mick Mulvaney arrived at work at around 7:30, as you mentioned, carrying a bag of donuts. And that's the kind of thing new bosses do. But we also heard from bystanders and people who gathered in front of the CFPB activists and others that Leandra English showed up even earlier, and she was ready to go even before that. And we know that Leandra English sent out an email, an all-staff email, in which she wrote, "Dear colleagues, I hope that everyone had a great Thanksgiving with Thanksgiving in mind. I want to take a moment to share my gratitude to all of you for your service. It's an honor to work with all of you. Best, Leandra English." And this is the key point. She signed it, acting director.
And she became acting director, by the way, on Friday. And just before 9 p.m. Friday, the White House issued a press release announcing the appointment of Mick Mulvaney, the White House budget director. English is challenging that move in a D.C. district court. What's her argument?
Well, her argument, but before we get to that, Reuters reported that Mulvaney responded to English and wrote his own memo. He said, "Please disregard any instructions you receive from Ms. English in her presumed capacity as acting director. If you receive additional communications from her today, please inform the general counsel." So he struck back at English.
And what is she saying about her argument?
Well, her argument is that in the financial reform, the financial regulations passed after the financial crisis, the Dodd-Frank bill, that it says quite specifically that if the director of the consumer the CFPB steps down, the next person in line will take over on a temporary basis. And so she's citing that as the basis of her lawsuit that seeks to prevent Mulvaney from taking over.
And the White House is citing the Federal Vacancies Reform Act, saying President Trump can appoint whomever he wants to the position. But the CFPB's former director, Richard Cordray, said today on Morning Edition that that law isn't relevant here. Let's listen.
"I have resigned. I'm no longer available. And therefore, the vacancy should be controlled by the statute that governs this particular agency, not a general law that governs many other agencies."
Is the administration on solid legal ground here?
Well, this is the hard thing. This is a fairly new bureau. It's been around for about 6 years, so there's really not much precedent in here. And we know that they're both citing their own legal claims, and so this really needs to be sorted out. You know, Politico got a memo from the CFPB's own lawyer saying it's my legal opinion that the president has the authority to designate an acting director for the bureau, and I advise all bureau personnel to act consistently with understanding that Director Mulvaney is the acting director of the CFPB. So that would seem to support the White House position.
What's the bigger picture here? It appears that, you know, Democrats and people who are in favor of the CFPB believe that Mulvaney is out to destroy the agency. What do we know about what he wants to do with the CFPB?
Well, we know that he hasn't been a fan of the agency or the Bureau whatsoever. As a congressman from South Carolina, he voted against the CFPB. And as President Trump's budget director, he co-sponsored a bill to kill the Bureau in Congress. And he's called CFPB a sad, sick joke in a comment he made.
And meanwhile, by the way, he's keeping his post in the White House. Is there concern that that would be a conflict of interest?
Right. He has a really big job with the White House as the budget director, and he deals with things like the debt ceiling. And, of course, there's this tax bill that the Republicans are trying to get through. So he's involved in all those things, which are really big responsibilities. Now, the fact that he's been designated to take on the CFPB as a kind of a side gig gives you some indication about how the White House sees this bureau. Certainly, it doesn't want it to be as activist and as aggressive in its enforcement as it was under Richard Cordray.
Is the Bureau going to be able to do anything while this fight is going on between English and Mulvaney?
Well, it's tied up in court right now, and so there's a lot of confusion and uncertainty. So in the short run, it would seem very unlikely. I mean, what everyone agrees on is that the president ultimately has the authority to name the permanent – to nominate the permanent director of the CFPB. So we'll see whether they move on that and get someone nominated and muster the votes from the Senate to get that passed.
That's NPR senior editor Uri Berliner. Uri, thank you.
You're welcome.
Ken Stern, a former CEO of NPR, recently took a year to, as he said, break out of his liberal bubble and meet people on the right, which ruffled the feathers of many NPR reporters who felt they'd already traveled that path, lived on it. But Stern says people who live along the Acela Corridor, that's a train on the East Coast, need to get out and meet the Americans he did when he went pig hunting in Gonzales, Texas, or visited the coal mine town Pikeville, Kentucky, for instance. His book is Republican Like Me. It's a play on journalist John Howard Griffin's 1961 classic Black Like Me, in which Griffin's painted his face black and traveled to the segregated South. Stern went to NASCAR races, conservative radio stations, until, as the subtitle suggests, he left his liberal bubble and learned to love the right. And he joins us now. Ken, take up the ruffled feathers first. You tell me the premise of the book in your words.
So my premise is actually a little bit different than you set it up, Robin, because my book's really not about the media. It's really about all of us, that we are increasingly in this world all living in bubbles with thicker and thicker walls. We're choosing to live in neighborhoods with like-minded people. We're all getting our content from self-selected media. We're not becoming polarized on the issues. Our beliefs on issues haven't really changed in the last 25 years. But our beliefs about the other side are becoming increasingly negative. My goal really was to leave my 94% Democratic ward in a 100% Democratic household and try to see things from the other side, as Atticus Finch said in To Kill a Mockingbird.
Well, you do say that you're not overly concerned about your colleagues' liberal views at NPR because it was outweighed by the obsessiveness of the NPR newsroom to show balance and the view from all sides. But you do talk about coverage that is obsessive about mass shootings but largely absent on the defensive use of guns. It means you dedicate oceans of coverage to the looming apocalypse of climate change, find little room for the concerns of the lukewarmers who want to debate the policy implications of it all. It means media largely misses, until this year, the hollowing out of the white working class. You know that that was offensive to many NPR reporters that you indicated. They're not as interested as you were when you set out on your year to know other opinions.
So, Robin, the trust ratings for the media right now ranks about at 35%. That's roughly the same as Donald Trump. Half the country thinks the media does fake news. One of the things I did during my year is just listen. I wasn't talking to people about the media, but they wanted to talk to me about it, probably because of my background. And they felt treated as cartoons. They felt they were patronized. They felt their views and concerns and issues about the future were left behind.
And I want to hear what you heard. But, you know, you're being called a cultural tourist. Brian Mann, staff writer for North Country Public Radio, upstate New York, says NPR doesn't exist in the bubble you lived in, that public radio has the largest team of journalists active in rural conservative areas of any media network, and they don't just drop in as you did. They live there.
You know, here's what I said in response to Brian, which is it really isn't about geography. If you travel the country and talk to people, they're going to say the same things I'm about to say, which is I think if you polled the newsroom of America, and this is not about NPR, newsroom of the major media organizations, I think you'd find a political weight on one side or the other. And I think that's a problem because I don't think NPR or New York Times or Washington Post, and this isn't about any particular news organization, they wouldn't cover race matters, for instance, with only white males, no matter how good, how willing to listen they are. And they shouldn't. You could say that on a lot of different issues. And I think you should say that about politics as well and express a concern about the results of groupthink. I mean, my book really ultimately is the effect of groupthink, of the confirmation bias on all of us, and the fact that we really need to work harder than we are to get outside of that.
Let's take one topic, coal towns. You meet people who've lost their livelihoods. You empathize with their plight and write beautifully, by the way, but write very eloquently. The country's prosperity, the future of the country is increasingly urban, multicultural, powered by a knowledge economy. It's an alluring vision, but it's hard for those left behind to see how they fit into that neat vision. They don't see a place for their rural towns or mining jobs or even their unabashed patriotism. That is true, and we've done many stories on that. What are you saying? Are you saying that out of empathy for these coal miners, we should what? Agree that the coal job should return even though the coal jobs are dead end and killing them?
Well, the coal jobs are gone because of natural gas and market forces, and that's really not the issue. My issue, actually, the broader issue, is the loss of the assumption of presumption of good faith between the parties and between different parts of the country. Because I'm concerned about the bonds of affection, you know, that Lincoln talked about 150 years ago, of people who fought against each other in the Civil War but needed to come together as a country. I'm concerned that those bonds of affections are loosening.
No kidding.
So it's not,
yeah.
So it's my issue, really. I tried to dive into the issues and see it from their point of view. But, you know, these are people who are labeled as deplorables or white supremacists.
Well, they really weren't. Let's take that up for a second. You're referring to Hillary Clinton's comment at a fundraiser for LGBT rights. She said half of Trump supporters were a basket of deplorables, racist, homophobic, she went on. But then she said the other basket of supporters are people who feel let down. And she described the same people you're talking about and told her supporters, you know, you have to empathize with them. Now, linguists have said she should have flipped the sentence because people only heard that first basket, deplorables. But also, we are now hearing white supremacists openly say what she said. They feel elevated by Donald Trump.
And of course, there are. I mean, so look, I spent a lot of time with Breitbart. And if you want to see sort of the end of Earth, spend time and go crazy, you spend time on the comment section of Breitbart. So I've met hundreds of people, and some of them scared the bejesus out of me. Paranoid, full of plots and conspiracies, and it really worries me. But most of the people I met fall into different categories. People who are responsible, respectable, concerned about their communities, seeing the hollowing out of their communities, see, you know, they're really on a 30-year losing streak. And they've seen that through Republican and Democratic administrations. And I think you see a sense of futility, a sense of abandonment that we should all have real concerns about. You know, as a lifelong Democrat, I always thought that was the province of the Democratic Party to worry about communities like that. I came back from my travels actually neither Republican or Democrat as an independent and somewhat concerned about the institutions and where they mislead us, but actually a greater faith in the sort of the moderation of the American people and the good sense of the American people. There was actually an extraordinary poll by the Washington Post before the last election, where they went to Virginians, an evenly divided state, a purple state, and said, they asked Clinton voters, do you have any close personal friends or family members who are voting for Trump? And they asked the question of Trump voters. And 60% of both said no. We're actually segregating ourselves into communities of like-minded communities. And because of that, it's much easier to demagogue the other side.
Let's just pick one thing that you did. You go on a pig hunt. Pigs enclosed in a wooded area. It's one of those places where you pay to go on a hunt. What were you trying to tell us about these hunters?
So I read an article in the Washington Post, and I read a quote by the head of Heritage Action who said, you know, the problem with the people in the Selma corridor is they're missing the awesomeness of America. And I said, well, all right, how do you find that? So I actually called up Tucker Carlson, who I barely knew, and said, Tucker, what should I do to find the awesomeness of America? And he said, go on a pig hunt. So I did. And part of this was to take me out of the comfort zone, go to places where I thought I would hate everyone, find people who thought differently, looked differently, acted differently than me. I mean, I went to Liberty University. I went to evangelical churches. But it was like the who of the people I ended up with. In the morning, I was with a three-generation family from Georgia, Paps, CJ, and Isaac. And Isaac was the same age as my son, 8 years old. And he ended up sort of taking me on as hunting mentor. In the afternoon, I was you know, with what I say in the book is sort of the hunting equivalent of a bar joke, a Hispanic ex-soldier, a black uniform salesman, and a Croatian immigrant, and me, a Jew from Washington. We were the group going out there, and it was very much different than you might expect if you were trying to characterize what a hunt in Texas would look like.
The 8-year-old in particular who's helping you is very charming. But look, I have cousins in Wisconsin who hunt. They fill the freezer with the deer meat that they then eat. There are those of us who just maybe don't embrace the slaughter of animals for sport. But guns for hunting, range shooting, competitive shooting, legal uses, that's not what most people are calling for regulating. The tension comes over, you know, background checks and bans on assault weapons and keeping guns out of the hands of the mentally ill.
So, of course, there's a cultural issue to this. People from different places view guns differently. But Gonzales, Texas, where I is about 8 miles as the crow fly from Sutherland Springs, Texas, where the church shooting took place just a couple weeks ago.
Right.
And one of the things is you look at what happened in Sutherland Springs. It's a horrible thing, but the liberals looked at it and immediately said, you know, this is a case for the banning of semi-automatic weapons, which we did in the 90s. And conservatives look at it and they saw a citizen with his own AR-15 end up killing the shooter or stopping the shooting. And they also looked at the sort of the facts of the case, which is sort of captured in the bumper sticker that I saw at gun shows, which is, I'd rather have a gun in my hand than a cop on the phone. And those are all, you know, legitimate observations, which we should acknowledge as we talk about the complexity of guns, because guns are actually a very complicated issue.
I know. But then you get to David Hebbenway, the professor of health policy at Harvard School of Public Health,
yes,
who has studied the use of defensive guns for decades. And he says evidence indicates that having a gun is not that protective. It probably makes your house less safe.
And you get John Lott, the conservative economist, saying exactly the opposite thing. I'm actually all for the gun control, but I've lost the sense that that's actually going to make a difference. We've driven down gun homicides in this country by almost 50% over the last 2 decades. And we've done that in ways that have nothing to do with gun control. It has to do with policing, yeah, and better opportunity. Those are the things we should be talking about, investing in and solving these problems, rather than going to sort of our old battle lines of, are you for gun control or gun rights?
Well, and your point is not demeaning fellow Americans. That's Ken Stern. His new book is Republican Like Me, How I Left the Liberal Bubble and Learned to Love the Right. He was executive vice president of NPR from 1999 until 2007, CEO until 2008. Ken, thank you.
Thank you, Rob.
It's the time of year when every day seems to have a name. Today is Cyber Monday. Tomorrow it's Giving Tuesday, when consumers are nudged to open their wallets for a good cause. Last year, global donations on Giving Tuesday topped $168 million, a new record. But how do you know your money's going to the right place? Jill Schlesinger is a business analyst with CBS News, host of Jill on Money. Her podcast is Better Off. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
And start with, how do we do this? Picking which charity you should donate to. Start there. We have pet causes.
Yeah, absolutely. And it should mean something to you or maybe someone close to you. But, you know, I guess you're going to have a real way to judge tomorrow, because all of us, we will be inundated with solicitations. And I think the most important thing to stress here is that we want to confirm that the charity is legitimate. You know, earlier this year, the IRS actually put out a warning and said there's a lot of scams associated with charities. Maybe they have similar names or around a disaster it often occurs. So the first thing, is this a legitimate charity? You can go to the IRS website, irs.gov. They've got this very cool select check tool. And that way you can search for and you can put the name in and make sure that it is actually a real organization that pays taxes or doesn't pay taxes.
Doesn't. Well, nonprofits. But how deep can you go? Because some people want to know, you know, is the ratio of advertising to actual good deeds in a charity a good one? Or, you know, how much do they spend on galas? opposed to how much they raise.
I think there is an organization that you're asking about. It's very fond. I just interviewed the executive director. It is Charity Navigator. It's got a star rating system. And what this organization does is they review many charities, many thousands of charities' fiscal performance, right? So what they're trying to say is, look, how much money is going into this organization? Let's say you send $100. What portion of that is going to support overhead? What's going to the programs themselves? And they'll break it out by category. But generally speaking, they really want to see about 75% of the dollars being sent in going out to the organizations you know, causes themselves. I think that's a good rule of thumb.
Well, and full disclosure, your friendly public radio station might be asking you for something tomorrow. But it's not just Giving Tuesday. The whole month of December is huge for charities. Some get most of their budget for the whole year at this time. And one of the reasons is taxes, people trying to get in donations that are tax deductible before the year ends. So what should people know in terms of taxes?
Well, first of all, you have to remember that charitable contributions, it's part of that laundry list of itemized deductions. So if you do not itemize, you don't have to really worry about this. I mean, you want good records anyway, but you don't have to do this. If you do itemize and you want to claim that deduction, you've got to have a receipt for anything that you give that's valid at more than $250. But, you know, there's a lot of different choices here. That means you can write a check, you can do it on credit card, you can text. If you are wealthier and you've got an investment account, you might want to give away stocks or mutual funds that have gone up a lot in value.
Or cars.
Cars, right? Don't sing that jingle right now. You cannot do that. You can give appreciated securities. If you're retired, you're taking your required minimum distribution from your retirement account, you may be able to send some of that requirement over to a charity and not have to pay tax on it. Tons of stuff out there. Good records. Don't fall for the scams.
Okay. Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. 1-800-7-SO-SOMETHING-LIKE-THAT. Thank you, Jill.
Thousands of people lined the streets to cheer the arrival today of Pope Francis in Myanmar. Francis met with the commander of Myanmar's military, who said there is no religious discrimination in his country. The visit represents a delicate diplomatic balancing act for the Pope over how to address a murderous crackdown against Myanmar's Rohingya Muslims. Governments around the world have accused Myanmar's military of ethnic cleansing against the Rohingya, and more than 620,000 refugees have fled to Bangladesh to escape violence. Myanmar's government has denied attacking civilians. Some papal advisors warned Pope Francis against even using the word Rohingya because Myanmar doesn't recognize the Rohingya as citizens. Francis will meet tomorrow with Myanmar's civilian leader, Aung San Suu Kyi.
To Illinois now, where thousands of inmates are being held in state prisons past their court-ordered release dates. In some cases, they stay incarcerated for many years after their time is up, costing taxpayers tens of millions of dollars. Why? It's a story Max Green from member station WBEZ has been following.
Last summer, a letter came into Mark Weinberg's Chicago, Illinois law office.
I don't know which is the first letter. This was from August the 8th.
It was from a man in a downstate prison. As a civil rights attorney, Weinberg gets a lot of letters from inmates.
Oh yeah, this is the first one.
The inmate laid out how the Illinois Department of Corrections was still holding him in prison even though he'd served his entire sentence.
Our response was, he can't be right. This is not believable. And then, of course, we found out that it's all too believable and is actually occurring.
As Weinberg started looking into it, he found thousands of men are being held in Illinois prisons long past the end of their sentences, which is costing the state tens of millions of dollars a year. Those men are facing the rest of their lives in prison, even though no judge ever gave them that sentence. And this isn't a secret. Legislators know about it, the Department of Corrections knows about it, but no one's doing anything. Probably because the men who find themselves in this situation, they're sex offenders. I began looking into this after hearing about a lawsuit Weinberg filed on behalf of those men. I went down to Taylorville State Prison, about 3.5 hours south of Chicago, where I met with a couple of the men who had written letters to Weinberg.
My name is J.D. Lindenmeyer. I'm 35 years old.
Lindenmeyer was arrested in 2005 and pleaded guilty to predatory criminal sexual assault charges. He was 23.
The original sentence broke down to roughly like 5 years and a month.
And how long have you been in here?
Pitt, 11 years, June the 12th.
He was supposed to be released in the summer of 2011, 6 years ago. Leading up to that date, he had planned to go to his mom's house, but his sister was still a minor.
16 years old when I was originally supposed to get out, so I couldn't go there.
So he tried two other places. First, his then-girlfriend's home, which was denied because she was too close to a daycare. Then the home of a friend. That was denied because Lindenmeyer wouldn't have his own bedroom, a legal requirement for some sex offenders.
Once I wasn't let go, I signed a piece of paper that basically says they gave me the opportunity to leave and I couldn't find suitable housing. So I sit for until I find suitable housing.
He kept trying. Lindenmeyer submitted his dad's address, but that was too close to a bike path. The home of his other sister was denied because she has young children. He even submitted his mom's boyfriend's home, but that was denied because he had a computer and was too close to a school.
My family isn't very well off financially, so they couldn't just afford to go out and get a place that they knew I'd be able to go to.
Lindenmeyer says he's been told he can't live anywhere that has guns, alcohol, or internet access. He can't even be in the same residence as a smartphone, computer, laptop, or smart TV. There can only be basic cable. And according to his attorneys, there are a lot of small stipulations often given to people with similar convictions. Like there must be a landline. There can't be any pictures of kids in the house. There can be no aggressive dogs on the premises. There can be no minors living at the same address, which would put most apartment complexes and trailer parks off limits. The law requires that offenders reside only at locations approved by the Department of Corrections, giving the Illinois Department of Corrections immense discretion. Despite numerous requests over months, the department refused to discuss any of these prohibitions or the issues they raise. When Lindenmeyer's younger sister turned 18, his mother, Denise, says he submitted their address for approval one more time.
And they said he couldn't come because of the internet. But my daughter was in school, and she had to have the internet. So I basically had to choose between my two kids.
Denise says even out-of-state family have offered their homes, but the Department of Corrections won't allow her son to leave Illinois.
I don't know what else I could possibly do. I've tried to do everything, so has everybody else.
Denise is on disability and has a fixed income. She says the family doesn't have much money, and her son's extended incarceration has cost them thousands, putting money into his commissary account and making the trips to prison, which she says they can afford to do only once a year.
It's just been a never-ending nightmare for me. I'm to the point now where, you know, I've been waiting for a miracle, and it's not going to come. And I'm just really starting to ask myself, is he going to be in there my whole life?
Picture a map of Illinois. There are nearly 5,000 elementary and high schools across the state. Drop 5,000 pins on that map, one for each. Drop 10,000 more pins, one for each of the daycare centers registered in Illinois. Drop 330 more in Chicagoland alone for each of the city's public parks. Drop hundreds more for movie theaters, libraries, malls, and anywhere else it could be argued that minors congregate. Quickly, the spaces on a map where someone like Lindenmeyer can go disappear.
I have been contacted by a number of families who are just looking for some relief and some stability so that they can move on with their lives, and it's hard to give them hope.
Elaine Neckritz was an Illinois state representative for 15 years before retiring in September.
To my mind, this is just, the law is completely unjust when it comes to the impacts on those families.
Neckritz says one of the major reasons things have ended up this way is legislators get political points for being tough on sex offenders. She says many of the measures were put into place with good intentions, keeping communities safe from dangerous offenders while they ease into life outside of prison. But even when proposed laws and regulations don't make sense or burden taxpayers or contradict the idea of meaningful rehabilitation, she says they still almost always pass.
They would just sail through because there was no objection to them. But as it turns out, as I've now learned, many of them are conflicting with each other. They're cumbersome and almost impossible for someone who's on the sex offender registry to comply with.
That's why Lindenmeyer and the others are suing. And it's why attorney Adele Nicholas, along with Mark Weinberg, who received that first letter, decided to take their case.
This is not about whether the crime is excusable, and it's not about whether these people should be criminally charged, criminally tried, and criminally sentenced. That has happened.
What it is about, Nicholas says, is whether the correctional system in Illinois is functioning properly and fairly.
Our clients have served their criminal sentences. They are not seeking to undermine the sentences that have been imposed by the judge. What is happening here is not what was imposed by the criminal judge. Our clients are serving time that they were never sentenced to.
Clients like J.D. Lindenmeyer from the beginning of this story. Lindenmeyer's 6-year sentence has stretched into 11 and a half years and counting, and there's no mechanism to release him. Despite multiple requests for the data, the Illinois Department of Corrections says it doesn't even track the number of people it's holding beyond their sentences. But the department admits it could be in the thousands. And based on figures from the department, that adds up to tens of millions of taxpayer dollars a year to house inmates who shouldn't be in prison. The Illinois Department of Corrections and the State Attorney General's Office refused multiple requests for comment about the existence of this situation and the lawsuit, citing pending litigation. Yet, IDOC has been trying to have the case dismissed. In the most recent hearing, that motion was denied. In her decision, Judge Virginia Kendall wrote, quote, "There is no particularly convincing reason for individuals such as J.D. Lindenmeyer to continue to sit in prison on the taxpayer's dime." For Here and Now, I'm Max Green in Chicago.
The publisher of Sports Illustrated, People, and Time magazine will soon have new owners. In a $2.8 billion deal made yesterday, Time, Inc. agreed to sell itself to the Meredith Corporation, which owns Better Homes and Gardens and All Recipes, among others. The deal was financed in part by the billionaire brothers Charles and David Koch. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik joins us from New York. Hi, David.
Hey, Jeremy.
And how big a deal is this sale?
It's almost more important symbolically than perhaps it is financially. I mean, it is the ultimate hollowing out of one of the great brands of American journalism, particularly newspaper journalism. I thought back to the great book, The Powers That Be, written by the late, great David Halberstam about the, you know, sort of these pillars of the American press. And Time, Inc., Time Magazine, I should say, was really among them. Now people are abuzz, President Trump picking a fight with Time over whether he was or was not about to be considered the person of the year, and they've certainly gotten a lot of attention for that over the years and been home to a lot of really good journalism. But I've got to say that Time Inc. has been diminished, and its brand's diminished, Time in particular, fortune as well, by just the vicissitudes of the magazine industry and the fact that you've seen slumps in revenues for advertising and print editions and the thinness of the publications that have ensued.
Yeah, Time Inc. reported a 9% drop in revenue in the last quarter. So what was in it for Meredith Corporation to take it over?
Well, funnily enough, it's not basically the titles that we've been focusing on for the last minute or so. At Meredith, which is based in Des Moines, they own Better Homes and Gardens, Family Circle, Shape, Parenting. They produce Martha Stewart Living for under a decade-long deal. These are, you know, titles that by and large serve a female audience, a relatively affluent female audience. And there are these titles that you might not think about instantly when it comes to Time Inc., but titles like Real Simple, Cooking Lights, Southern Living, In Style, perhaps Entertainment Weekly, and certainly, of course, People Magazine. And these are titles that might fit very snugly with Meredith's existing stable of magazines. And if they combine those, they might be able to present themselves to as a marketing force, particularly for women, particularly for affluent women, as a way of saying to those seeking to reach consumers, go to us, you'll get one-stop shopping. And I think there's a real question about the longevity of some of these other titles at Meredith. They're going to be slashing backroom costs, but they also may be looking to shed some of these titles that they're about to acquire.
And what about the Koch brothers? They put in $650 million for this deal. They are known, as our listeners know, for financially backing conservative politicians and causes. Why are they interested in this?
Yeah, and it's a particular strain of conservatism. I mean, they're libertarians at heart, but it's a kind of corporate libertarianism. Ultimately, some would say belatedly, but probably quite sincerely, they came to support certain kinds of social positions, libertarianism, like the rights for gay marriage. But you've seen them on the state and federal level pour money in. And so the question is, are they going to influence the journalism? Now, one longtime editor of an outfit, Reason magazine, has had support of the Koch brothers over the years, said, you know, there's some distinctions to be made between the institutions that the Koch brothers found, the ones they control, and the ones that they serve to donate money to or contribute to. I believe it's David Koch who's given money to the ballet here in New York for many years. There's also been some sponsorship of the Museum of Natural History up here in New York. And although there was a bit of a kerfuffle over certain kinds of phrasing and exhibit involving global warming, something that Koch Industries have great interest in as they are opposed to regulation of the emission of carbon, you know, by and large, they're seen to be good philanthropists. We should add that they actually – that Koch Industries gives certain money to NPR in a sense through underwriting spots where they advance their brand, although they don't do any advocacy around it. This – through which they're helping to finance this deal is their venture capital deal. They've promised to be a passive investor. Meredith says the Koch brothers won't have any members on the board of directors of the new expanded company. And they say that they're not going to play any role in influencing editorial content. All I can say is that that remains to be seen.
So we shouldn't expect Time magazine to be doing a big feature on the front cover about the need for tax cuts or reducing regulations because of the Koch brothers' influence.
You know, I think that if so, that would violate all kinds of promises that are being made now. I think the real question is whether Time magazine continues under this expanded Meredith stable, whether Meredith ends up selling itself off to some other much larger platform, you know, a Verizon type that wants more editorial content to pump out online, or whether it spins off for a decent amount of money, things like Fortune, Time, perhaps Sports Illustrated, and whether the Koch brothers themselves might then be interested in having a bite at the apple and in owning this outfit themselves. The Koch brothers had expressed some interest in the Los Angeles Times, and they said that they were interested in doing it in part because it was available and relatively underpriced when they thought they might have a chance at it, and also because they thought it might serve as a remedy for what they see as the biased liberalism of a lot of mainstream journalism. You know, Time magazine itself has this place in American history. Its founder, Henry Luce, talked about the American century for the 1900s and really sort of established that after World War II. And it was it figured in the center right of American politics. And yet, you know, now I think it would be seen as part of the same part of the media as everyone else. If the Koch brothers were to take that over, it might be a very different kind of publication.
That's NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. David, thank you.
You bet.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.